TUC Radio San Francisco, Time of Useful Consciousness. Behind the scenes of the Millennium Meeting, how to stop the global financial casino. When I met Martin Kaur in San Francisco in 1993, he warned us about globalization. He repeatedly took the long journey from Malaysia, where he lives, to initiate campaigns against the WTO, the MAI, and what became known around the world as the Seattle Round on World Trade. He has built one of the most powerful consumer movements in the Third World, the Consumers Association of Penang. Today, he is well known as the president of the Third World Network. His most recent book is Globalization and the South. At the counter-teach-in to the Millennium Meeting of the United Nations, organized by the International Forum on Globalization, Martin Kaur again introduced a new set of arguments and analysis. He says that what we have today is the Robin the Hood economy that robs from the poor to give to the rich. The instruments of theft are global trade, global finance, global investment, global technologies, and the WTO. This system seriously hurts the Third World, but it is about to bring down the economies of the industrialized countries as well. Here is Martin Kaur's well-reasoned arguments why this may become true. He begins by describing what kind of economy Malaysia and the countries of the South desire to build. Martin Kaur.
Coming from a developing country, or at least from the South, I don't know what a developing country is anymore. At the root of many of our social problems, at least, is the fact that we have very unequal distribution systems in terms of wealth, assets, income, and so on. This is so for all our countries, whether in the North or South, and of course internationally as well. So if we want to get a system of economy and society going that fulfills basic needs, that is environmentally sound, and so on, at the national level, we have to first resolve the gross inequality of wealth and income. So changes in lifestyle, changes in technology, changes in the use of local materials, changes in priority in government budgeting so that government money and investment goes into basic needs, provision of primary health care rather than super medical technology that benefits the rich rather than the sick, and so on. So these kinds of things are eminently possible. They are simple solutions to great problems. I don't think that the solutions are that complicated or complex. What is difficult is to get the conditions going such that these simple solutions can work. And the major impediments, really, are the distribution of wealth, power, and property. Now, what has this got to do with globalization and the United Nations? This kind of simple development policies that can get rid of some of the most fundamental problems of poverty, environmental degradation, social inequity, and so on, in the third world countries, is now being blocked by that model of globalization that we are seeing in front of us. Just talking of economic globalization, we have the globalization of finance, trade, investment, but most importantly, we are now seeing the globalization of policy making. That's the most insidious and most dangerous form of globalization. Policies that used to be made by countries and coming under the mandate of national governments, in which case we can then try to influence our own national policies by influencing the government or forming our own governments, are now being made by international agencies or by powerful countries that then internationalize their own ideologies and policies by imposing it on third world countries. And in the WTO, of course, the leverage is that of legally binding trade agreements, that is, you sign on the dotted line, and if you don't follow what you have signed on, which is legally binding, we are constantly reminded by Charlene Bajarski, you know, all the USTRs are top corporate lawyers. They tell you have legally signed on to an agreement and you can't get out of those agreements. So the leverage in WTO is that if you don't follow the rules, there's a dispute settlement system which will punish you through trade sanctions. That's the leverage of the WTO. And the WTO, of course, is more powerful in the long run than the IMF because you run to the IMF only when you're indebted. When you get out of debt, you can tell the IMF goodbye. I think Korea, for example, is going to tell the IMF goodbye. But if you trade and you join the WTO, you are there forever, or at least as long as the WTO survives. The policy we have today, of course, is the Reagan-Thatcher policy of neoliberalism, which is bad enough for England and for the United States, but when exported to the third world countries, it's a disaster. We have seen 2 decades of disasters, and the Washington Consensus has produced one string of problem after another, one crisis after another, to the point where the consensus makers themselves are split and quarreling among themselves. The consensus has split and broken. You know, the Washington Consensus is almost dead, but the corpse does not recognize, or the body does not recognize that it is a corpse and is giving a few last kicks, trying to show wonderful statistics that economic growth gets rid of poverty. And we said, well, we know that economic growth of the right kind can reduce poverty. We are not really quarreling so much about that, although we can have a big debate too, what kind of growth leads to what kind of poverty reduction. The whole problem we have against you is that your policies don't lead to growth anyway. It leads to recession and countries are collapsing. For example, the kinds of policies that Indonesia had to undertake led it from a plus 8% growth into minus 20% growth in 1 year. Of course, we are not for growth for growth's sake, but we are for growth of the right kind. And I think this is the kind of answer we may have to give when people say, well, why are you against growth when the third world countries are for growth? We are for growth if it produces food. We are for growth if it gets rid of pollution. We are for growth if it is to build low-cost housing for the poor. We are not for the kind of growth that is useless, that is benefiting only a few people, and so on. Now, in the 4 aspects of economic globalization, finance, trade, investment, and technology, we have seen what the financial system, now being controlled by a few giant financial institutions and players, the kind of havoc that it can wreak across the world. And I think there is now an emerging consensus that freedom and mobility, especially of short-term capital, is extremely damaging. It will damage not only poor people, but it may damage the entire system itself. The problem is that in the past, we had the classic debate between, or struggle between, what we call industrial capital, the big capitalists who produce things, and finance capital, that is the banks and financial institutions that get profit, although they don't produce anything physical. And then there was a fight between them. Now, of course, the industrial capitalists found out that they shouldn't be wasting all their time in producing things if they could also make 50% profit or 200% profit in a few months. And the industrial capitalists themselves have become finance capitalists. So the two systems have merged. And now finance is driving the car. And it started here in the United States, where Wall Street has really taken over. And the freedom of capital to move from place to place due to the breaking down of financial barriers is now a very, very major threat to the whole system. What to do about it? Again, the solutions are very simple. Re-erect the barriers. Okay, for example, we have a system of currencies which are floating in really crazy ways. Even between the yen and the US dollar, it can go up and down 40% in a few weeks. So there has to be some way of stabilizing currencies, maybe going back to a fixed exchange rate system. Reforming the global financial system. I don't know why Rubin called it architecture. Everybody now calls it architecture, and Rubin has faded from the scene together with his new architecture. They are not even doing much in relation to the plumbing anymore, let alone the architecture. But there has to be an overhaul of that financial system. That will take a very long time because the finance people are really entrenched in power. So what can a country do? Well, it can institute its own controls. It can refuse to be part of the free flow of funds. It can institute national barriers. If you can't have an international Tobin tax, try it at a local level. You can do it at a national level as well. Malaysia did some of it when it came under attack and by speculators. It was quite successful in some of its measures. It came under attack for those measures, but the economy recovered to some degree, and now people are looking at that as an alternative model that can be done. But if you do remain under the IMF, for example, Indonesia, then you are not able to follow some of these alternative paths because I remember when Malaysia instituted capital controls, three Indonesian ministers that week said, well, we are studying the issue and we may want to institute it in Indonesia. Thereby, the IMF team flew from Washington and got the Indonesians to sign a new letter of intent in which one of the conditions was that they will never introduce or institute capital controls. So you have to get rid of the power of the IMF, otherwise it won't be done. Now, the consensus is that financial liberalization is bad for you, but trade liberalization is still good for you. And I think we have to break that kind of thinking as well. There is this cruel advice to developing countries that if you liberalize your imports, it's good for you because cheaper products will come in and the consumer will benefit. What happens is that when the cheaper imports come in, for most developing countries, they are not able to offset that with higher export earnings. Why? Because their exports are in commodities. Commodity prices have collapsed, mainly because commodity agreements have been destroyed in the Thatcher-Reagan period. And if countries want to diversify out of commodities, for example, by processing their raw materials, there is a higher tax on processed raw materials in Japan, in Europe, or in the United States to prevent developing countries from doing so. And if they want to go into industrial products such as textiles, or if they want to expand their agricultural products, they are not able to do so because the West is still highly protectionist. So it is not true that there is free trade. There is highly protectionist trade when it suits the big powers. Most developing countries are unable to increase their exports. But at the same time, they are forced to liberalize their imports. So what has happened is that most of these countries have had a wider trade deficit. In fact, the average trade deficit in developing countries has grown by 3 percentage points of their GNP, which is a very high figure. And this has added on to their debt crisis. This is one of the leading factors for the debt crisis and why there cannot be a resolution of the debt crisis. So the fact or the idea that trade liberalization is good for developing countries and is helping their poor people, and that those of you who are campaigning against trade liberalization in the South are doing a disservice to the poor people in the South, this argument is a cruel joke. Do not take it seriously. I'm sure you don't, but I'm giving you the intellectual arguments to counter that. Now, the role of the United Nations, the UN today, I think the Guardian had a very interesting article that said that the UN used to be a joke because it had not very much power, but today it is the villain because it is joining in the system. And of course, what we need to do, we the peoples who are supposed to give some backbone to the UN, we have to tell our governments and the UN that the UN has to be different from the Washington Consensus, especially since the Washington Consensus is collapsing. The UN, of course, has been decimated because in the 70s and 80s, the developing countries tried to make use of the UN for the new international economic order. The developing countries had the audacity to think that just because oil and other natural resources were located in their countries, that they think that those natural resources belong to them. That was a very audacious idea. And they had to be taught a very difficult lesson. And of course, the war against Iraq taught them a lesson where oil was concerned. And the destruction of all the structures of the United Nations, the decimation of the UN Center for Transnationals, the downgrading of social and economic activities of the UN, the refusal to pay taxes to the UN that the US has done, and the transferring of all these powers to the WTO, the IMF, and to the World Bank is at the root of this problem. In order to redress the situation, firstly, we need to reform the United Nations to make it worthy of our support. We need to fight for those reforms, whether it's the FAO or whether it's the WHO or whether it's the General Secretariat. We ourselves are very unhappy with what is going on in many parts of the UN. But secondly, we need to campaign among our own people to change public opinion so that the United Nations can be restored to the spirit of internationalism, which must be different or even opposite to the practice of globalization. The old international solidarity spirit that the UN should embody must be the opposite to the practice of predatory, imperialistic kind of globalization that we have today. We have to get rid of this kind of globalization so that we can return to a system of internationalism based on solidarity. And that is the challenge before us, we the peoples. Thank you very much.
That was Martin Kaur, president of the Third World Network, Malaysia. He was recorded at the counter teach-in to the UN Millennium Meeting in New York in September of 2000. A trained economist and former college teacher, Martin Kaur has for years accurately predicted the tendencies of globalization and the maneuvers of the WTO. I asked Martin Kaur for an interview, and we met the following day. Martin, should we start with finance? We're talking about what changes would be necessary to make the global finance system more equitable.
I think the financial system is in a crisis because it has liberalized too much. You know, countries have lowered their barriers and allowed financial institutions and financial flows to come in unregulated, both in the rich as well as in most of the poor countries. And this has led to very frequent financial crisis, not only in Asia, but also in Russia, in Brazil, in Mexico, in Europe, in the early 90s and so on. So what we really need to do is to reintroduce regulations at the international as well as national and regional levels. Internationally, for example, there should be a system in which exchange rates do not shift so violently. It should be more stable. We used to have the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates. We could even think of going back to that, or at least of a system in which changes in exchange rates are within a certain band or range and not be gyrating in such a volatile way. Secondly, in countries which are the source of finance, for example, the United States, there must be regulation to prevent big financial institutions like hedge funds, mutual funds, pension funds, and so on from getting large amounts of credit and speculating or manipulating financial markets. Because this has been happening. If you look at the LTCM hedge fund scandal, one would find that a company with $3 billion of capital was able to borrow more than $100 billion and use that money to speculate and play the financial markets, you know, with assets far beyond the equity level. This should be controlled because it can lead to not only great instability and systemic collapse, but also the violation of smaller and poorer countries who become victims of speculation and you might say the removal of their hard-earned money. So we should also think of international regulations such as a kind of currency transaction tax, popularly known as the Tobin tax, or at least if individual countries were to impose their own national Tobin tax, for example, a tax on the inflow of short-term capital, those countries should be allowed to do so without their being labeled as financially paria or as countries where people shouldn't invest in or as countries that are conducting outmoded financial rules. In fact, this is not outmoded, it is far-sighted. We can also have systems that prevent countries from getting into debt. And if countries already are in a debt crisis, then there should be guidelines and rules on how to manage a debt crisis in a fair, equitable and systemic manner. At the moment, there are no such rules. When a country defaults on its debt, it has to run to the IMF. The IMF does not help that country to have a systemic resolution of the debt problem. It only lends to that country, and the country then has to swallow many conditions, most of which are inappropriate.
Can you name those again, the adjustment conditions imposed by the IMF?
Well, typically countries have to have very high interest rates. They have to cut their government budgets. They have to close down financial institutions. And this, of course, all leads to recession, which leads to even further collapse of foreign confidence. So neither does the currency recover, nor does the economy improve. In fact, conditions worsen. So what we should have really is a system of orderly debt workout, similar to a bankruptcy procedure in the United States under Chapter 11, in which a company that gets into trouble can apply to a bankruptcy court. The court can then order that creditors and the debtor gets together and they work out a fair solution in which the creditors take some of the losses, continue to lend to the company, and the company can continue to function, so that in the end the company is saved and the debt burden is shared more equitably between the creditor and the debtor. So similarly, when a country gets into a debt default, creditor, banks or countries should come together with that country, and they should all work out a system of partial debt relief and partial repayment and rescheduling. And meanwhile, fresh funds can come to that country, so that the country can continue to have its economy functioning. Now, that kind of mechanism is very badly needed, but is not there. And this is where I think the IMF and the financial institutions have failed us, including the United States.
How does your debt management compare to debt forgiveness and the Jubilee efforts?
I think the debt forgiveness refers to the debts that have already accumulated over so many years, and there is no way, you know, of resolving them already. And in fact, the debt has been repaid many times in terms of the high interest that has been charged and so on. So we should have debt relief, in fact 100% debt relief for a large number of countries that are poor, and partial debt relief for other countries that are in serious trouble but may not be chronically poor. Without that, I think we are going to have a disaster. We can have this bankruptcy, international bankruptcy court procedure that can institute a resolution to debt, which will perhaps not be called debt relief then, because it's an agreement that the creditors will take some of the losses, as they should. In any country, if a company that borrows money or an individual that borrows money is unable to pay back, then the creditor will take some of the losses. We just want to apply that principle to the international sphere.
How does speculation in currencies actually play itself out at the third world level, because that's where it's most likely to show the biggest fluctuations?
Well, one major mechanism is called short selling the currency. That is, the foreign institution, like a hedge fund, comes into the country and borrows local currency from the local bank, or borrows local currency in the international currency market with a promise to pay back that local currency at the then prevailing rate of exchange. Meanwhile, the institution then unloads hundreds of millions of US dollars or billions of US dollars worth of the local currency into the local currency market. the central bank, the local central bank, then buys up the local currency and changes it with US dollars in an attempt to maintain the currency. Eventually, the central bank runs out of reserves or money and gives up the attempt. There is then a sharp devaluation of up to 50%, or in the case of Indonesia, up to 80%. The Thai baht, for example, fell to almost 50 baht to $1. So the speculator then, when he has to repay the local banks, instead of having to repay, for example, $1 billion, will have to only repay $500 million of US dollars in order to repay the same amount of local currency that he had borrowed, thereby making a clean profit of $500 million. So this is how currency speculation works. And in the meanwhile, the country is bankrupted. In the case of Thailand, they lost $20 billion US dollars in a few months. So it's a scandal, it's an outrage, and it should not be allowed to happen. But the greater outrage is that the United States or the IMF does not even want to recognize that this is an outrage. They consider it to be part of free financial flows and the freedom of finance. And I don't see why developing countries should accept it. We should call a spade a spade. This is manipulation, this is cheating, this is exploitation, and it should be curbed.
That was an interview with Martin Kaur. He is president of the Third World Network, Malaysia. The Tobin tax Kaur is referring to is a tax on the transactions in the global financial casino. Speculators trade almost $2 trillion of currency every day, and a 0.1 or 0.25% tax would discourage short-term speculation and create a fund for social and environmental projects. The Tobin tax is supported by a growing number of parliamentarians around the world, and there is a current effort to have the Tobin tax voted on by the U.S. Congress. Check out the website of the Tobin tax initiative at www.ceedweb.org/IIRP. That's ceedweb.org/IIRP. This is the third program in an 8-part series on the complicity of the leadership of the United Nations with globalization and corporations. It was recorded in September of 2000 in New York at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization. You can get a one-hour program that includes Martin Kaur for $12. The transcript of this full 4-hour series is $12 as well. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 1-877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.